Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it is a real treat to have my friend Ben Winters with us today. He's going to be talking about his really amazing new book, Big Time, a novel. And Ben, it's great to see you, as
Great
always.
to see you too, Patrick. Thank you so much. And hello out there, everybody. I'm delighted to be with you.
Yeah, let me just give you a quick intro, which is courtesy of Mulholland. Ben H. Winters is the New York Times best-selling author of The Quiet Boy, Underground Airlines, Golden State, and The Last Policeman trilogy. His books have won the Edgar Award, the Philip K. Dick Award, the Sidewise Award, and France's, I don't speak French, Grand Prix de l'Imaginaire, I don't know, Award.
That sounds pretty good. Grand Prix de l'Imaginaire.
Okay, thanks. Winters also writes for television and lives in Los Angeles with his family. And I understand that your daughter is a very talented singer.
That's true. One of my daughters is a very talented singer. The other one's a very talented dancer. So I have they're actually up there. And my dog is annoying. So I'm going to sit down so I can pet him while we do this so he isn't a pest. Yes, I do have a talented singer daughter.
I saw a post somewhere where you were doing an open mic.
We were on a little trip just visiting friends, and we went to dinner at some bar, and they had like an open mic, and she was like, can I do a song? I was like, I guess. So we went up and I played guitar and she sang a Taylor Swift song. It was amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, let's just kind of dig right into it, because there's so much to talk about with this book.
Thank you.
It's just an amazing work. About a remarkable group of women, really, in one sense. I mean, the cast that you've created, but also I'm glad that you put in the little note that I think you said the germ of the idea started with an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if that's precisely true. I mean, I've always been really interested in time travel stories and in time, just the idea of time as a dramatic device, right? But we went through a period, I think it was during COVID, where we watched, and with the kids, we watched a lot of the old Twilight Zones. And we were sort of, Googling, like, which are the ones that are, that sort of hold up the best, and that, especially for younger viewers. And there was this one, I think I said, I can't remember exactly which one it was, but the premise of it was that they find this camera that can take pictures of future events or something like that. And then it becomes they're betting on horse races. And I just little things like that are like, oh yeah, there's this part of me that I think about time travel stories, like they should be like Westerns or superhero stories. It's like a genre, in and of itself. So I do think that's sort of where this started. I got really into it for a brief, like for a period of like, I want to read everything about time travel. And then I was like, okay, so what's my take on this? Or like, where can I go with it that feels like a book that is the sort of thing that I write? And so for me, it's always like, okay, so how can we kind of blend that into a real a crime story? And so it became this thriller. It is really, it's a race against the clock kind of story, which felt exactly appropriate. You know what I mean? Like that it is about racing against the clock. And then meanwhile, the sort of overriding metaphor of the book is about how time is like so precious. And yet what would happen if people could take it from us,
The greater philosophical question, which you raise or kind of have fun with, what is time? What exactly is it?
I know it's so weird. And like philosophers and scientists have been talking about this for a long time. And also writers, like it's in so many different idioms, like the ones I was just using, race against the clock, or like, running out of time. And so is time an actual, is it a substance? Is it a thing that we own? And we say like, I only have so much time. I've only got 5 minutes, right? So you're right there, you're literalizing this idea that you have a certain amount of this thing, but it's also like something that we travel through. It is the tunnel or the river, through which we are going through life, all of these things. So there's some passages in the book that sort of get into this idea of like, and as in some of my other books, I think it's like, so how do we literalize those metaphorical ideas? How do we like think about these things that are figurative ideas in literal ways? And what would that mean? And what would it feel like,
Since we can get into sort of this esoteric territory, do you have in your mind, I've explained this to some people. Do you have in your mind a view of the past? You mentioned are you a river guy? Are you a tunnel guy? And when you
mean
think
in
about
terms of a controlling metaphor of what time is?
Yeah, well, when you think about the time and how it stretches backwards, does it follow a particular shape in your imagination? Or do you think about it that way?
I think a road, to me, it's a road, right? Like if you think about the journey of your life, and there's a whole nother set of metaphors about we're traveling on the journey of the path of life, or that, you know, we're walking down this road, two roads diverge in a wood, et cetera, right? So like, if you look back on your life, it's like, what is the journey that I have followed? And those are the years of your life that lay out behind you. And what's interesting is they also lay out in front of you. You just don't know how far, you don't know how many miles of road you've got left, right? You don't know how many, how much sand is left in the hourglass, or whatever the metaphor is, you know? And in the book, the idea is that someone, I don't think it's a spoiler, like we get to this relatively early, the notion that it might be possible to quantify how much time somebody has as if it is an asset or a possession, like their physical form. They also have this certain stock of time. And what if you could take it? And then what happens to them? And what, you know, how does it work? Sorry.
Right. Well, just for the folks watching, can you just sort of, I don't know if you have a brief kind of introduction to the book and what it's about? We've talked about it a little bit, but then we can dig a little bit deeper.
Yeah. Sorry, Archie, quiet. Sorry. I mean, basically it is about the main character is a woman named Grace, who is like, I'm going to walk around for a second. She's a single mom who works at the FDA, and she's basically like many of us middle-aged people, she is starting to feel like life has passed her by, right? And that she has no sort of controlling purpose, and that sort of the years of her life have left her in this kind of state where she's sort of like, what's my purpose? And then she discovers this strange photograph of a woman, as she goes about her very boring job, she comes across what appears to be evidence that a woman has had this terrible experiment conducted upon her. And so Grace is activated to try to find the woman who appears to be missing. And meanwhile, we, the reader, have met this woman, and we know that she has in fact been kidnapped and that someone is taking her somewhere, and then she escapes. So it becomes a sort of, in a way, it's a very structured, like a very traditional thriller. Grace, our middle-aged sort of melancholy, you know, woman, is like, she's trying to find this mysterious young woman at the same time as this vicious sort of mercenary character is also looking for her. And so structured like a thriller, but one that leads to this sort of conspiracy, almost like a corporate conspiracy novel, where we are finding out what was done to this woman and why, and trying to save her before, and then ultimately to unearth the whole thing. So that's the bones of it, you know? And like in a lot of my work, Patrick, you've read a bunch of my books, like there is this kind of, I try to deliver the kind of satisfactions of whether it's a thriller or a kind of a manhunt novel or a detective story, but then have this sort of larger science fiction conceit going on. Oh, excuse me. Hello. this is Archie. Yeah, he's delightful, except when I'm trying to work or do something like this.
Yeah. Well, and also there are these distinct early on, there are kind of, you dial in on three main voices for a while, then the cast broadens a bit with other folks.
And I think those three main voices, Patrick, are like the protagonist, who is this unlikely hero, and right. Then there is this woman who has been kidnapped and then escaped, and she's terrified, and there's something very strange going on inside of her mind, right, that she can't understand. So there's this sort of unraveling, and then there is Desiree, who is the just a badass mercenary, essentially, who kills and kidnaps for money. And that was a character, I've never written anyone like that before, really. Just like, truly, she's a pure villain. Although by the end of it, she has her own kind of a form of moral evolution. She was really fun to write, to be totally honest. Like, that was kind of like that when you're working, there's always one sort of, usually there's one part of a book that's sort of like dessert. It's like, oh, this is like, oh, I get to write a chapter for her. It's so fun because she's just so mean and ruthless.
And we get, you give us little bits, little hints of, who she is and what kind of background she comes from, you know,
yes,
and she's,
yes,
you know, she's obviously got some pretty heavy shit going on in her past.
Yeah. Although what was fun for me about Desiree is that, and I sort of came upon this late in working on the novel, is that she is also in a sense a gig worker, right? Like a lot of people that we imagine were like, she's a mercenary, she's hired, it's project-based work. She gets paid a flat fee no matter how long it takes her.
Right.
And so there's these passages where she's hunting for this woman that she's contracted to kidnap and deliver. And she's thinking about how many hours it's taking her and how her fee amortizes out and how she's got to wrap this up so she can get another job. And like, I just think it's a very familiar feeling for a lot of people, of feeling under the gun in terms of time and money. And so even though she is this ruthless killer character, there is an element of like, well, what's it like to be an Uber driver these days, or to be any kind of like, or even someone who writes books for a living, or like, I'm paid, God, you know, God willing, I'll keep getting paid to write books, but you get paid, the contract doesn't change depending how long it takes you. So there's always this like that. And so anyway, so it sort of feeds into the larger theme of the book, which is like, how do we think about the hours of our lives and literally what are they worth to us? So even from the bad guy, quote unquote, her point of view, we have that stream going on in the book.
Have you found just in your own personal life this, that you've had to take steps to reclaim your time, reclaim your life?
I mean, constantly. I actually, as I've been thinking about this book, and especially since I've been talking about it with people, like, I actually think it's, in a way, it's like the primary relationship in our lives is, what is our relationship to time? How do we think about the hours of our life? And like, you know, with stuff like social media, it's such a cliche at this point to be like, oh my God, it's such a waste of time. And there is value to it, to connecting with friends, to learning information, all that stuff. But we all know that it's also sort of ruthlessly designed to take our time from us, right? And like, to like, when they talk about their metric for success on their end is how many minutes of attention can we draw from people? We are paying them, we are literally paying them with the hours of our life. And like, that's kind of creepy when you really think about it. Like, I, Ben Winters, will only get so many hours to walk around on this earth and do things and learn things and give to other people. And like, you know, and like, here I am turning over, shoveling over these minutes into Instagram or whatever it is. It's like, that's interesting, you know? So yeah, I think about it a lot. It's a struggle, especially as someone who, like, I work for myself in general. My work is project-based. I am only paid on delivery of a finished manuscript. You know, you get the advance, whatever. It's like, so I'm always thinking about, like, how long is this going to take? What is the best use of my time today? What projects might potentially be of value? Whereas which projects are you kind of taking a flyer on? It's like all that stuff, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's see here. Let's talk a little bit about, we were talking before we got started here about what all we can say and what we can't say.
I know, it's always, it must be a big problem in your line of work, Patrick, when you're interviewing crime authors. Cause it's spoilers I'm tiptoeing around, right?
Right, right. Okay. So we have Allie and we're in her head. And
Allie's the woman who's on the run, right?
She's on the run. Yeah. Well, at first she's kind of kidnapped and isn't sure what the hell's going on.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and we learn, you know, we're in her head, which is an increasingly claustrophobic and strange place to be. Because
I mean, basically what happens is things start slipping out of her mind. Like, all of a sudden she can't remember the name of her husband, right? Like, she's all of a sudden just like, she has this kind of sense memory of like a guy with facial hair and a bowling jacket, but she can't get to the name. And then new memories start to appear in her head that she is confused because she doesn't know, they're not her memories. And all of a sudden they are so visceral and real. And then, so she starts to seek out those places and then more and more come. And so there's this sort of like a sort of tide going in and tide going out going on in her mind of like who she is. And it's very distressing. And it was hard to write. It was a big challenge. And it's always hard to write things that are, I don't think it's like a psychotic break in that sense. Like, that's not what's happening. It's something that is a science fiction thing that's happening, but it is always interesting to try to write anything that is like, it has to do with just like pure consciousness. And like, what is it? How does it, like, how do we as human beings process thoughts, you know what I mean? And memories, and like, as opposed to writing, like, he walked into the room and there was a bookcase there, like, that sort of actually trying to replicate the experience of thought is like a kind of very interesting challenge as a writer.
I remember, reading James Joyce, you know,
I was just thinking about that. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, yep. not to get super pretentious here on our video, but it seems to me like he was one of the people that really tried, especially with Ulysses. You know, I make no claim to have read Finnegan's Wake, although I
no,
have.
I think, but actually, you're putting your finger on it. That I think one of the achievements of modernism, of the modernist sort of canon, was that we are going to try to take a step closer into to replicating what it feels like to think. And so Ulysses, or the Virginia Woolf, you know, To the Lighthouse, Mrs. Dalloway, like those books are, she's trying to just be like moment to moment inside of a brain. And like, I don't make any claim to be a writer at that level, but I think that those tools are available to us, you know, because of the work that they were doing. Like George Eliot, it wouldn't have occurred to like in Middlemarch to try to, although to take that level of connection to the sort of moment to moment of thought. And so particularly with a character like that, where I'm writing this woman who is literally in a way losing her mind, like pieces of her mind are escaping from her, it is helpful to really try to write inside of her thoughts from that sort of deep point of view. And hopefully that's one of the pleasures of this particular book, big time, is that these three point of view characters have three very distinct, not only voices, but like means of presenting those voices. Like Grace is this kind of weary, and she's very like, she's funny and she's droll, and like she recognizes that life is a struggle. Mm-hmm. And so her voice is a little bit sarcastic and funny, and like, and but then she gets this sort of call to heroism, you know what I mean? And we sort of take that journey with her.
Yeah. And then we have her child,
yeah,
who in my opinion steals the show.
Oh, thank you.
I thought River was just a remarkable character.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about River and how they function
yes.
in this book.
River is Grace's child, Grace's only child, and they, as you say, are non-binary, they, them pronouns. And River, and like, so River basically becomes Grace's sidekick, essentially. Like River, and they have the kind of relationship that a lot of us have with our teenage children, which is that River is sarcastic and annoyed and annoying, and Grace is doing her best to be accepting of River's pronouns and River's presentation. And like, but like, you know, and I have a little experience with this, but like kids today, like kids always have their ways of being in the world that we might find confusing or potentially worried about them, or like, and yet it is everyone's prerogative to express their identity and to be who they are. And so anyway, so Grace has this relationship with her kid. She loves her kid, even though her kid is a pain in the ass. And River is very annoyed all the time by their mom, and it's actually, it offers a way of, like Grace sees River looking at her. In other words, Grace sees her kid examining her and examining her choices. Like, in other words, like I see my kids and they look at me, and I know that the way that they are thinking about what it is to be an adult is by interrogating me and my wife and the way that we have chosen to live in the world. And so Grace's disappointment in herself, and her sort of like, she meant one day, a long time ago, she wanted to be a crusading lawyer and change the world and stand up for the little guy. And instead she is a kind of mid-level bureaucrat at the FDA examining medical devices. And
she excels at what she does.
Right. She's great at it, but she has this feeling like it doesn't matter. Right. And so when she looks at her kid, she is worried that River thinks, oh my God, my mom is this failure. My mom, you know? And so, so eventually River, because River gets suspended from school, has suspension from school, River ends up going with Grace to work. And I think as parents, we've all been in situations like this where it's like, Grace is in the middle of this like project at work, which is trying to save this woman that she saw in this picture. And now she has to take her kid to work, but River ends up helping Grace to find the woman, and the two of them kind of charge into it together, and it changes their relationship, and River grows and changes. And I don't know.
River helps. It seems like River helps, and we do get little hints through the grandmother character about,
yeah.
And it's kind of a, not to interrupt myself, but it's kind of a multi-generational perspective you see here.
Yeah, Grace's mom, Kathy, we'll go back to River in a second. It's just for your viewers. Grace's mom is Kathy. So the last piece of the puzzle in the household that Grace is not only raising, she's not only a single mom raising River, but she has her own mom, Kathy, who lives with her and is just an enormous pain in the ass. Because Kathy is, like a lot of older people, she's not aging particularly gracefully. She does not like the fact that she is increasingly unable to take care of herself, and she's bitter about it. And like, she's funny as shit and she loves Grace, but she's also super critical of her.
She's a ball buster.
And in a way, having her in the book, first of all, it's just another point of view, but it's a way of sort of literalizing the metaphor of the book. Like, we are all facing times passing, and like, we're all, one day we'll be where Kathy is, which is like thinking about those things. Like, basically there's a whole running thing in the book where she's been told she's not allowed to drive anymore. And right. She wants to go to Costco. So one of the things that Grace is dealing with, even as Grace is trying to like charge across the country to save this girl's life, and like, she's in danger and she's uncovered a conspiracy, her mom is calling and saying, I want the car. I have to go to Costco. Do you need anything? So it's like, what? But what were we saying? Oh yeah. But as someone who is dealing with the fact that she's running out of years of her life, it's hard. So I forgot where we were, but yeah, Grace.
We were just talking about how Kathy fits into the picture of this cast and crew.
And I think I write early on in the book that for Grace, it's like living with both her child, who is 15, and her mom, who is, I think, in her 70s or early 80s. It's like a funhouse mirror of her life. Like, she sees herself, the potential that she perhaps once had that she feels she has lost, and also where she's eventually going. And it's sort of like, it's a little crazy making for her sometimes.
Gotcha. I think we may have a little glitch with the Zoom, but
I think we're
caught up. Can you see me okay?
I can. Yep.
Here. Okay, great. Let's dig into, this sort of, we're at this strange crossroads, obviously, with technology, you know, and we've all seen what Elon Musk has been doing, you know. Was that whole, you know, human implantable tech kind of thing influential to you here? Or did you go into the weeds researching that? Or
I didn't go that far. I mean, I did somewhat. I learned a lot about the sort of basic technology that is in the book is in portacaths, which are the things that if someone needs to have blood drawn repeatedly, or perhaps something injected repeatedly, intravenously, rather than having to over and over again do a needle stick, they will implant something often here that's like basically a little port, so they can keep on doing it without having to keep on piercing the skin. So I learned a lot about those ports. It was pretty interesting. That became the kind of central idea that they're like, this character, the woman in the photograph that Grace sees, who we're going to learn is Allie, has this port implanted, and we're like, and she doesn't remember who put it there or why, which seems to me like terrifying that you would sort of find something like that and not know where it came from. I'm not like a hard sci-fi guy. Like, when people say my books are science fiction, I'm always like, okay, are they? Like, to me, I'm like a mystery writer, and I like the kind of conceits, the sort of big idea stuff. But like, I've never been the kind of, you know, there are some science fiction writers who like love to like learn all about what life would be like on Mars, or like the sort of like, how could you travel in time? Let's do the math on it. I don't have a head for that. And it's just not where my mind goes. Yeah. But I like to do just enough research to make the book feel like real and grounded and lived in, so that when I describe something like a portacath, even though it's going to be in my book, it's going to be doing something wicked and mysterious and evil, it is described as if it's the one that you would get after your heart surgery, you know? So it really feels real. Yeah.
Have you by chance read, what's his name? Altered Carbon, Richard Morgan.
No, but you're not the first person to suggest it to me. I have not read that one.
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, it's not the same quite idea, but it has a similar element of, I won't give it away, but
now I'm going to put it on my list. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I do see, you know, I'm a huge Philip K. Dick fan.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, and that's the kind of science fiction I like, which is more, and it's amazing going back and reading his stuff, and, you know, people kind of dismissed him as, you know, this paranoid, you know, and so much of what he wrote about has come to pass.
Yeah. It's remarkable. And I mean, there's all sorts of like mystical visions of Philip K. Dick and who he was and where there's a ideas came from, but I think the truth is he was just, you know, he also of course had some uh-oh, my internet okay? Can you see me?
You froze there for a minute, but now you're back.
No, please. Am I okay now? Am I back?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. I was just talking about Philip K. Dick. Maybe the ghost of Philip K. Dick sort of entered into the machine and troubled our internet connection for a minute.
Right.
Seems so like tell us a little bit.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Dr. Is it Stargell?
Stargell, yeah.
And especially the durational element, which I'm guessing was your original title.
No, but that's a good guess. I like that. I actually had this title. I had this title, I don't know, almost throughout. I had this title for a long time, which is pretty unusual for me. But I do like the durational. Yeah, I mean, basically, Dr. Stargell, like Grace, as she is trying to figure out where this portacath, this came from, she's doing her research and she finds this academic paper in this obscure journal of philosophy and science about something called the durational element. And, you know, it's very... you know, it's made up, but of course I wanted, when you get to that part in the book, I want readers to go, oh, that sounds kind of real. That sounds like it could be a real thing. That basically this scientist, has discovered, at least theoretically, the idea of something, an element in your body at the atomic level that is essentially your store of time, the amount of time that you will exist as an entity. I don't even say on the planet, I'll say in the universe, like as an entity in the universe. And then when you run out of it, you're gone. And it would, you know, now on a certain level, that's obviously impossible. That's a crazy idea, but you know, there are so many things that we take for granted now that if you one had seen them say in the Middle Ages, you would go, well, that's just magic. The idea of a light switch or certainly a smartphone or like the streaming, what we're doing right now, talking from a distance of however 100 miles. Like, so I like to think about that when I propose science fiction conceits and try to make them sound real. It's like, we can't know what sorts of things sound impossible now that with enough progress and investigation might indeed be real. So try to present them that way.
Well, then it's, you know, some of what you bring up, you know, I could imagine, you know, a yogi deep in the Himalayas saying the same thing, you know?
Totally. And I think there is something cool about that, about the intersection of philosophy and science, that like, well, if we think about time, it is useful for us as human creatures who are trying to make the most of our lives to consider that time is limited and precious. Yeah. And so isn't it interesting to think that that might be literally so, that time is valuable and precious and we only have a certain amount of it. So what if that were, so the fact that that might, the idea that that is physically true is useful intellectually and philosophically. And then, of course, we get into the larger thing of the book, which is just that if that were true, then, of course, that fact would be exploited.
Yep.
And anything that any asset that one can imagine, whether it's labor or real estate or, you know, people's, the hours of their lives, like if it exists, it will be stolen, leveraged, sold, you know what I mean? So that's right. The book sort of is, the wicked world that the book is hinting toward is what right. would happen, you know?
Right. It seems to me that this book, I really love your previous book, a couple books back now, The Quiet Boy.
It Thank seems you. Like no, that was the last one. That was the most recent one before this one.
Version? Okay.
Yep, it was. Well, I would spend a couple years.
We got this one too, though.
That was a reissue. So the bonus room is a kind of asterisk, because that was, that book was actually titled Bed Bugs and came out in 2011, and the publisher decided to reissue it with a new cover, with a new title.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
There nice. You go. Yep.
Well, The Quiet Boy, you know, can we digress just for a moment and can sure. you give them, because what an amazing book. And it seems like it's sort of spiritual kin in a way to some of the ideas that you express here.
You know, that's funny. And I saw one of the reviews somewhere mentioned that, and I was like, oh, totally, that's true. I hadn't really thought of it, but it does. The Quiet Boy is about a boy, like a teenager, who has a fall and needs an emergency surgery. And then when he wakes up from the surgery, he is like catastrophically altered, that he basically has no emotions or thoughts and doesn't speak and simply walks in a circle and does that permanently. It doesn't age or grow or he sort of becomes this kind of golem. And so the book is structured like a legal thriller. It's about the lawyer who is suing the hospital for medical malpractice, but it then becomes so much more than that. There's also this sort of idea that there's something supernatural happening to this kid. And I guess this book, it is a spiritual cousin in that it is also about medical malpractice, and it's about the kind of the contrasting possibilities of science versus something that is beyond science, you know, something that is impossible.
Right. I mean, just that image of him just walking in that,
yeah,
that circle, yeah, while the doctors are trying to figure out what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
Was there any kind of, was that completely made up, or did you come across any cases of similar things?
It's very made up. I mean, there are certainly things where people wake up from surgeries, mm-hmm, catastrophically and tragically altered. And there are, so I have to go back a little to my research on brain disorders. There's all sorts of astonishing and bizarre things that can happen to the human mind. And there's like they're called prion disorders, I think, that mad cow disease was a famous one where something can happen and then years. And this is the medical explanation that's ultimately offered in The Quiet Boy, you know, in tension with the supernatural explanation that this kid had something kind of like a virus was buried in his mind a long time ago, and then something activated it, and it just the surgery activated it, and he ended up being so. Now, the point of the book is that of The Quiet Boy is that we never really fully get that you as the reader must make your own decision about whether it was medical or supernatural, what's happened to him. In this book, in Big Time, I think I am saying that it is real, and that it is ultimately something that we have to, that the characters are right in sort of ringing the alarm bells about it and what it would mean, you know, if people are stealing from other people.
Right. And as in this book, as these two people essentially begin to inhabit the same vessel,
yeah,
I could say, which may be a bit of a spoiler, but anyway.
Well, we said, I mean, that basically like other memories are coming into her mind, and it's basically like we are witnessing this transition of who she thought she was. Yeah, it's sort of hard to explain without reading it, but like she's the effect of having time taken from her has caused the universe to sort of to screw with her identity in an interesting way, basically.
Right. It almost mimics, whether you believe in it or not, the dissociative identity disorder, yeah, in a sense. And I wish I could have been like a bird hearing you and Josh go back and forth with edits on this book.
My wonderful editor, Little Brown.
Josh Kendall, you sort of dedicated partly the book to him, who's a brilliant guy.
He's a brilliant guy, and he's a very patient editor. And I think I said this in my acknowledgement, like he's so generous with his time, because with this book in particular, and certainly with Quiet Boy too, there are just so many iterations of the idea. And like with this one, it really started as being, it was just a much different book. It took me a while to get to the book that it is. And I think, which is sweet, but that like this one started as more of a corporate espionage book, and it was sort of inside the corporation that was doing the evil things. And like, I had this urge to write something that was almost like a spy novel, like with corporate espionage. And then I sort of had to really peel back and go, no, I really like, the outsider characters. I like someone who is, doesn't know any, quiet, who doesn't know anything and is trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And that was Grace. And it was when I found Grace that I really had the book, but it took some doing, you know?
Was Bernie a nod to our friend Lou?
No, you know, it's so funny because I love that last name, Bernie. And I don't know that I realized I was taking Lou Burney's name until what's funny is that then Lou blurbed the book. And so his name is on the cover. And then my wife was like, do you realize that's the same name as the character? I was like, oh, that's so funny. I totally
and
didn't.
And you have a Lou in the book too.
Do you want, oh, who's Lou? Is he the, her boss?
He's her boss.
Yeah. No,
nope. Is that right? I think
all, yeah, that's right. All completely accidental and just like, you know, I think names just kind of get in your brain. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's really funny. Lou Burney's a great reader, though.
Yeah. Let's see. There isn't really a whole lot more we can say here. You guys are in for a real treat. And before I open, the people are watching, and sorry, everybody, I'm kind of flying solo. So I will pay attention to your questions and we'll ask some of them here. But before I do, tell us a little bit about what's going on with TV and Hollywood, some of those projects that you're working on.
Oh, yeah. Well, the big thing is this show Tracker, which is based on Jeffrey Deaver's novel, The Never Game, which I wrote the pilot. And now it's on. So I'm an executive producer on the show, and it's on CBS on Sunday nights. And it's a big hit. We just got picked up for season two. So here, if you haven't seen it, I hope people will tune in. I'm really proud of it. And if you know Jeff Deaver at all, he's the nicest guy, and it's he's just been he's wonderful. Been great about it. Yeah, it's really fun. So that's the big thing. I mean, so I'm so sorry, Archie. Be quiet. Sorry. Down. Good boy. Yeah. So that's been the big thing in TV, and TV's been weird because last year there was this epic strike. So we had started. What was then called The Never Game. We shot the pilot at the end of October of 22, I think. And then CBS picked us up to series, and we were sort of getting going. And then there was the strike. So we weren't able to premiere until February. But yeah, it's been great. It's been really fun, and kind of, it's a whirlwind. TV is a lot of work, but it's great.
Was that your idea to adapt the book, or were you hired to...
I was not my idea. I was very fortunate to get the gig. Basically, the star of the show is this guy, Justin Hartley, who was on the show, This Is Us. And he and Ken Olin, who's the director, they had basically come up with this idea. We should option this book for Justin to star in. And they were sort of, there was a hunt for a writer. And I got my hat in the ring through just a series of, you know, connections. And it was, and I met with them and I ended up writing the pilot. So it was good fortune. And, you know, it's like anything, you just got to do your best when you get these opportunities, because Hollywood is, it's tough. It's tough to get anything cooking. So this was really, this was a good one.
Do you like being in the writer's room? Do you, that kind of process?
I do. It's, you know, there's pros and cons, as with everything, just like there's pros and cons to writing a book where you're sort of all alone, except with your dog. You're all alone. And it's, there's times when I'm working on a book when I'm like, God, I wish I had a writer's room right now. You know what I mean? I wish there was a group of people here that I could break story with. And in the writer's room, it's great. I mean, you basically, if you have the right group of collaborators, it is incredible generating story together. And then one person goes off and writes the script. And then there's all these, the drawback of TV writing is just that there are so many levels of notes and, you know, that by the time you have the finished script, it can be very, very different than your original impulse, which can be good because oftentimes things get better, but also oftentimes you end up feeling like sort of disconnected from it in this way. Whereas with a book, it's like, for better or for worse, it's all you. You know what I mean? Like, you just, it's the product of one mind. So it's just a different experience.
Have I'm sure some of your books been optioned.
Oh, yes, they have. And I've written pilots based on The Last Policeman. I wrote a pilot based on Golden State, but none of them have made it to air yet. I think that it's interesting because the experience of adapting Jeff's book and having it go has taught me a ton that I think will be useful to me as I move forward in my career and my attempts to get my own stuff on air. It's just like, there's really interesting, there's a very complex and tricky process of turning a book into a show. And I think, I've learned a ton from this. So we'll see. See what happens next time around.
Cool. Let's see. Let me look for some of these questions. And we have an international audience.
All right. All right.
Yeah. Let's
see. Getting a real tour of my garage here, because I sort of keep shifting positions to calm Archie down. But now I think we're good.
Now, is this your office as well?
Kind of. Basically, it's a converted garage. We actually just did this like in the last month or two, so I'm getting used to it. It's a converted garage. It's mostly for the kids to hang out in, but I also have a desk set up in here, so when they're at school, I do this sort of stuff.
Let's see. Okay. Yeah, a friend. Okay, Stefania, who's our friend in Italy, watches a lot of our programs, and she's a big fan of yours. She asks, Mr. Winters, what's your own relationship with time? Is it something relative?
Stefania, it's a good question. I mean, like everybody, I think especially now, I feel like our culture has made, because of the internet stuff, it's like,
and as someone who works for himself, and I have to sort of structure my own days when I'm not in the writer's room, when I'm not working on TV stuff, if I'm working on a book, I have to structure my own days. There's no one to tell me, okay, it's time to, you know, take a break. It's time to work on chapter two instead of chapter four. Like, so that has taught me a little bit. I think I might be better than, I don't know. I won't say better than other people, better than I used to be about time management, that I have had to learn over the years to control my own clock. You know, I think one thing about being a writer that a lot of writers will tell you is that you can never fully feel like you're off the clock, like, because you can all, I could theoretically always be writing. So it's like, you know, at the end of the workday, when I'm just hanging out with my kids or whatever, or like visiting with a friend, there's always a little part of me, at least, that's like, you should probably get back to work. And I know it's not healthy, but that's just what it is, you know?
Or is there a part of you that's not really there with them?
There is always that problem too. I think I've gotten better about that over the years, about really, when I'm not work at, you know, at the computer, about trying to turn it off, but you it's hard. You know, there's a great Sondheim song about that, which is Finishing the Hat, which is, it's from Sunday in the Park with George. And just this idea that you can, if you're in love with a painter, just be prepared that if you're talking to him, he's in his head, he's painting something, you know?
Right. Okay.
Let's Thank you see. For the question, Stefania.
Yeah. There was a good one here that I seemed to, okay, this is interesting. You know, writers in some way, I don't know if all writers, but are interested in having their work outlive them, you know, creating an immortal story, right? And the question is, what are the characteristics to make a character or a story immortal, in your opinion? I guess if you knew that, you know.
Yeah. It's the famous, the last line of the Shakespeare sonnet. So long lives this, and this gives life to thee. Like the that's the, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? It's like, whatever. If I knew, I would do it every time, I guess. And I think that's the sort of thing where, like, you gotta, it is a fool's game to try to chase something, that just to try to create something because you think it will be successful or you think it will be immortal. The best you can do is like follow those ideas that seem to speak to you and make you excited and interested, and just like do your best. And then it's up to the showrunner on Tracker, when, you know, once we had done the episode one and episode two and episode three, and we were sort of getting ready to get on the air, and like done the focus groups, and that, he's just like, well, now it's up to the TV gods. It's like, well, now it's just up to the literary marketplace. Like, you got to just, at a certain point, it just goes out there, and whether it's successful or not, whether it outlives you or not, it's so out of your hands. You got to just go on to the next one, you know?
Right. Well, you know,
plus I'll be dead, so I won't care. I won't be here.
That's true. Yeah. Well, anyway, whole other question, story there, but you do read books that you sense are kind of outside of time in a way, where they're not really certain books you read, and they're very of a particular time and place. Sure. You know what I mean?
You feel it. Yeah.
You feel it. Yeah. You're like, all right, well, this is, and sometimes they don't age particularly well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas some, you know, other books seem like they're kind of outside that. They're tapping into something that's, I don't know, archetypal or.
Yeah. I agree with that for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know about my work in that sense. And I can't really think about it. I'm not even like,
no.
I don't even like to read them. I don't know if people, if other writers you've talked to, like, I never go back. I guess if I'm working on, like, you know, trying to make do a TV version or something, or there's someone who's interested in it, like, I might look at a book, but I'll never really go back and just reread it, because it's just like, I can't, because I'll find things that I don't like about it, or I'll feel disappointed, or I'm also just like, why am I dealing with this? I already wrote this. Like, I want to write something else. I want to think about something else, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know how close I've come to anything that'll like outlive me in that sense, but I'm not the person to ask, you know?
That's right.
You know?
Right. Michelle says, you mentioned Sondheim. Do you have any interest in playwriting, or have you ever taken a stab at it?
I have. I actually did theater. I did some theater writing a long, long time ago, and I love it. I actually worked on a musical. I did book and lyrics for a couple different things, but theater is tough. And not that fiction writing is easy to make a living in, but theater is
particularly tough because it doesn't pay very well. And also it's all nights and weekends, you know? So once I started a family and I was married and moving around for my wife's job, it became impossible to even really be in that world. But I do miss it. And lyric writing in particular, I find to be a fascinating and kind of delightful thing. And it's like, in a way, lyric writing is like mystery writing. Like you're searching for these small details that make it perfect. You know what I mean? Like it has to be exactly right. So I find that. And like Sondheim did write, he wrote some mysteries and he loved to make crossword puzzles. So it's all of a piece. Like, how do you get it exactly right to sort of match up? I don't know. I find it to be a fascinating art form.
A couple of people are saying, what a beautiful dog. We think your dog needs a treat. Oh boy.
Archie.
Hey, Archie.
You're famous. Yeah, he's a German
begging
Shepherd.
Can he spell?
No, he can't. That's a picture of him I have somewhere where I was writing on the couch and he jumped up and my wife took a picture of him with his hand on the sort of manuscript with what looks like he's holding the pencil. So it's as if he's actually doing the work. You know what I mean? He's just mad because I'm online. Like he'd normally just be asleep right now if I was just writing, but because I'm not looking at him and gazing at him and I'm engaged elsewhere, he's punishing me. You're a bad. Yeah, I know. Anyway, he's amazing.
Well, let's see. Just a lot of other really nice comments. You know, you got some fans on here. I'm trying to look for any specific questions.
I'll take all nice comments. I love readers. It's so funny because I love the TV world and it's a delight and a joy to work in the TV world, but there's something so, I don't know, the relationship between author and reader is so special. And like, I did an event last night, an in-person event, and like just seeing people who've gathered together to like see an author talk is just like, it's such a special thing.
Let's see. I have a question from a first-time author who would like to know if you have any advice on writing scenes.
Just in general?
I get maybe just in general.
I mean, every scene, don't forget, you have to ask yourself, what does this person want and how are they trying to get it? Right? Like in every human interaction, like just don't forget there has to be a point of view. And by point of view, I mean like someone is after something. They're trying to do something. Whether they're trying to seduce someone or threaten someone or bully someone or charm someone. Like a lot of times in a detective story, they're trying to get information. How are they trying to do it? Or they're trying to like steal something. How are they trying to do it? What is the motive of the scene? I think when things are flat, it's because the author doesn't know what these characters are trying to accomplish in this moment. And you can have tons of beautiful description and like interesting like background shit, but like I would make your first pass on a scene if you don't know how to do it just about these two people talking and what are they trying to get from each other. That's like the most sort of elemental piece of any section of a book. I'm going upstairs. Come on, Archie.
So we're getting the full tour of the Winters house.
I know.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's
are you in your house, Patrick? No, you're at the store.
I'm here at the store. Yeah, I'm upstairs in this little annex space we have as we kind of gradually take over the entire building.
Amazing.
But I'll let you go. And thanks so much for spending the hour with me here.
Oh, such a pleasure.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us. Again, Ben's brand new book is called Big Time. And it's fantastic. And we just got in a nice batch of autographed copies.
You got them. Good.
Yeah. Just got them yesterday.
Yeah. I had someone on Facebook ask me if they said they bought it and can they send it to me and I'll sign it and send it back. And I said, I can't really do that, but I told them to go to you guys to call you because you've got some. So there you go. So if anyone wants a signed copy, Poison Pen's the place.
We're the place. Yeah.
Now, I really appreciate it, Patrick. It's always great to talk to you. And thank you everyone for listening and for reading.
Sounds good. Thanks, everybody. Good night, Ben. We'll talk to you soon.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.